It's not difficult to see how aerial surveillance by drones would be an immensely useful tool for journalists. They can provide a safe way to report on floods, fires, battle zones, but they also have the capability of peering into our backyards and even the windows of our homes. What kind of rules of ethics are in place to protect our privacy from curious journalists? Joining us to talk about that are David Carson, photographer with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He manages the paper's drone journalism program. He joins me in studio. Mickey Osterreicher is the general counsel for the National Press Photographers Association, NPPA. He joins us by phone. Mickey, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And David, great to have you with us in studio. Nice to see you. Let me start, David, with Mickey, with you. It seems the genie is out of the bottle with this now that the FAA has given its approval for the use of drones. Do the ethics and the law have to play catch-up now?
I think the ethics and law are always playing catch-up to technology. It's really nothing new. This... It's interesting for me to see the public hysteria over drones. It's the same as it was over 100 years ago when George Eastman invented the Brownie, and for the first time somebody could take a camera in their hands and go out in the street, and everybody was concerned as to whether or not the right to privacy as they knew it back then was over. So the law is always catching up to technology, yes.
Do you really think there is a hysteria about this?
I do. I think that, you know, every supposed drone sighting, people see them in the sky. If you've ever actually seen one, they're very difficult to see. They're white and against the clear blue sky. It's very hard past the 100 or 200 feet to see where they are, even when you know that they're there. And so when people are reporting, pilots in particular, that they're seeing drones fly by them or near them, especially when they're traveling that fast, we've seen from the FAA reports themselves that most of these have been unsubstantiated.
David Carson, is the public upset about what the Post-Dispatch is doing?
You know, at the Post-Dispatch, we are following the FAA guidelines that they laid out last year in the Part 107 regulations. And, you know, we registered our drone with the FAA, and we had one of our photographers, Christopher Lee, who's actually more of the manager of the drone program. He's our aviation geek on staff. And he went and he passed that test. He became a certified pilot, a remote pilot in command. And that authorizes him to aid other photographers like me in using it there. I am also trying to get my certification, and we're working to get as many of our photographers as possible certified to use these things. But, you know, we're going to continue to, you know, practice good journalism ethics. You know, we're not going to use the drone to peer into somebody's window. I don't see making a picture with a drone as being radically different than me flying over with a helicopter and making a picture from a helicopter or an airplane. We're going to be making sort of similar sorts of pictures like that. Now, helicopters has a bottom of about 500 feet you can typically photograph from, and a drone, it levels off, it tops out at about 400 feet. But, you know, I can promise you the Post-Dispatch is not going to be using the drone to peer into people's windows because, you know, we have lenses right now today where we could do that from the street, and that is a violation of someone's privacy, and, you know, we don't violate people's privacy.
Well, how are you using it?
So we've used it for a couple of things. Christopher Lee did this great 360-degree pano from 350 feet above the new NGA site that really gave this great perspective of what that site looked like, and you could zoom in and zoom out from it. J.B. Forbes, another one of our staff photographers, was out at Art Hill and used the drone to do some video footage of the renovation of the King Louis statue out there. So we're going to use it where it's going to enhance the news coverage for our readers.
Mickey, what is the NPPA doing with regard to guidance and the use of this this tool?
So we've been really involved with the use of drones for news gathering probably now for 5 or 6 years. Back when the word drone really just indicated some type of a military aerial platform used for either surveillance or for attacking people overseas. We think that it's the next natural tool in news gathering. You know, for the most part, news organizations, most of them can't afford helicopters or fixed-wing aircraft. So this allows them a way of providing a different perspective on news stories. I mean, when you think about natural disasters, for example, if there's a flood or a tornado or a hurricane, the president or the governor will usually come in, and what's the first thing that they do? They take to the air so they can get a better perspective on the amount of damage that you can't see from the ground. And so it's the kinds of things that David just described that will allow both individual journalists and news organizations to use a drone in place of a fixed-wing or rotary wing aircraft. It's much more economical, and it's certainly a lot safer. Another example would be a forest fire. Let's say you have a crew that's on the ground covering that fire, and let's say it's out in California. You've now got a Bell Jet Ranger that's going to fly 100 or 150 miles out from its base to get 30 seconds or so of high-definition video that, in coordination with firefighting efforts, I'm not just saying put up a drone. You need to coordinate with people. And that's one of the things we're involved in, is making sure we're all good stakeholders in this. But it makes more sense to then have that crew that's on the ground with a Part 107 certified pilot put that drone up, get the same 30 seconds of video, and come back down again. It makes more sense than having a 300-mile round trip in a Bell Jet Ranger that runs around $1,000 an hour to operate.
Dave Carson, you're sitting here just nodding in affirmation.
Yes, you know, last year during the flooding on the Merrimack River, we would rent a helicopter and go out and tour, you know, through some of the damage, and that was very expensive to do. You know, if the regulations for drone usage had been out at that time, you know, we would have utilized a drone at that time. And there are, you know, there's a, you know, the FAA has laid out a number of I think fairly sensible, you know, guidelines for, you know, use. You know, you have to operate a drone within your line of sight, so you can't operate it when you can't see where it is. Your altitude is limited to 400 feet, and your speed is limited to 100 miles an hour. You can't fly the drone over crowds of people or people that aren't participating in your shoot. You're limited in your time you can fly before or after the sunset. And there's procedures in place for reporting if you have an accident as well. So, you know, there's weight restrictions, you know, and there's also restrictions on where you can and can't fly. Like, you can't just put a drone up out by Lambert Airport because that is controlled airspace. And so I think one of the great things that Part 107 is doing is established a set of rules that everyone can play by, and then it's going to take ethical people and responsible people to play by those rules.
One of the things that confuses me, if it has to be in line of sight and you're covering shooting a forest fire, you can't be that close to the fire to maintain that line of sight, can you?
Well, you know, I think the line of sight is a good rule to have. It helps you maintain control of the drone, and that's what the FAA's current rule is, and so that's what we're going to abide by.
Mickey Osterreicher, your thoughts about that?
I absolutely agree with David. They've set out, and we worked very closely to make sure that we had some common sense and least burdensome rules. I mean, originally, in order to get a Section 333 exemption, which was the only way you could operate a drone for commercial use, is you actually had to have a pilot's license, not just a drone pilot's license, but a pilot's license and also pass a medical certification. So that didn't really make any sense in terms of spending upwards of $10,000 and $30,000 to get your private pilot's license and then qualify for medical when you're not going to be up in an airplane where you might have a medical issue. So the fact that the FAA finally put in place last August these Part 107 rules, we are really encouraging all members of the media to be responsible. And as a matter of fact, we've been doing some drone journalism workshops throughout the country in partnership with DJI and Pointer and Google News Labs and Matt Waite from the University of Nebraska Drone Journalism School. So we cannot stress the safety issue any more than we do. And in terms of the ethics, clearly we believe that the laws that are currently in place regarding privacy apply to drones. As David said earlier, you know, there is the ability now, using a long lens from the ground, to look through somebody's window, but that would be an invasion of privacy. So having separate and distinct laws based on a technology, we don't think that that's appropriate.
Well, how about just flying over someone's backyard en route to someplace else? I mean, are there concerns about that sort of thing? A person could be sunbathing. They may not be photographed, but this thing is flying by anyway.
I don't see that as being radically different, though, than me flying by in a helicopter on my way. And I'm not currently – there's no current limitations on me and what I can photograph from a helicopter that I've paid $1,000 an hour for. And so I don't know why there would be limitations placed on a drone or what a drone can photograph when it's operating, you know, legally there.
I totally agree with David. That's one of the reasons that the FAA was put into place, so that we could have uniform rules throughout the country. If you can imagine what it would be like to try and travel through the air and use regular commercial aircraft, if every state had a different rule in place, so that as you flew from one state to another, or in this case, from one municipality to another, the rules of the air were different, which is why the FAA basically says that they have federal preemption over the airspace. And they've been talking about from the ground up. I think that that's probably going to be adopted in terms of, not adopted, but rejiggered in terms of now with drones. I think we will probably see some case law that will show that people have certain privacy rights in a certain amount of airspace. But I think one of the things that we'll probably look at, and I think it'll be determinative, is there was a case 2 years ago up in front of the Supreme Court called Jones. And it basically talked about GPS tracking and what the government could and couldn't do. And the case really turned on the amount of time that they were GPS tracking the suspect, whereas a limited amount of time wouldn't be considered a Fourth Amendment issue, whereas an extended period of time would be. So I think in the example that you just gave, if somebody's just overflying, that's one thing. But keep in mind the line of sight. There's not going to be a whole lot of overflight going on because you have to keep this within line of sight. But eventually we're going to get beyond visual line of sight. The other issue is flight time on drones. They right now fly on batteries, at least the ones we're talking about, and their limit really is about 20 minutes of flight time. So the fact that people imagining drones like flying over and loitering over areas, back to what my example was, I think if some drone is flying over your own property for an extended period of time, we may see case law develop that might constitute an invasion of privacy, depending on what's going on. So right now, really, the rule is when you're out in public, there is no reasonable expectation of privacy. It's why we can be photographed and recorded, you know, dozens of times a day by surveillance cameras, by dash cams, by police wearing body cams. So the same thing is true when you're the exact opposite. When you're in your home, that's where you have the greatest expectation of privacy. So it's those privacy laws that actually developed out of what I talked about earlier, the advent of the Brownie camera, and privacy concerns back then, that should be controlling rather than something that's specific to drones.
I want to come back to the law in just a moment. But first, coming back to Dave here, what is your range with this line of sight rule?
Well, so the times where I've flown it, you know, it has lights on it and stuff. We've flown it, you know, hundreds of feet away and stuff.
Hundreds of feet as opposed to a mile.
No, we're not. We have not, at this point, have not flown it a mile away. You can't use binoculars. Binoculars does not count as line of sight. It's with your eyes. And, you know, I think we are erring on the side of caution with this. You know, we don't want to be, you know, the news organization that wrecks it for everyone else. And so we're going to operate professionally and responsibly and ethically, you know, so that, you know, so that this news gathering tool can be, you know, used by others and grow throughout the country.
Is the quality of the image through a drone camera equal to what you might get from a helicopter?
You know, that's dependent on the imaging platform that you use. You know, there are drones out there. We can mount our regular cameras on them. Our current drone takes 4K video footage. So, you know, that's pretty good.
Well, I've heard high definition mentioned a couple of times. Apparently, that's a capability.
Yes.
Yeah. Mickey, let me come back to you with regard to this issue of the law. We've been talking for the most part about rules that the FAA has made and the organizations like yours made. What about the law? Is there a law out there yet that basically determines and provides more than just a guideline through rule?
Well, these are not rules in the sense of that they're just general guidelines. The FAA regulations come with civil penalties for violating them, and they're fairly significant. So it's the rule of law, even though they're not legislated, they're more promulgated. But we're now seeing many states and municipalities enacting their own drone regulations. And as a matter of fact, it's gone to the point that the FAA hasn't exercised that federal preemption yet, where they basically say nobody else is allowed to enact any other rules except ours. But what we have seen is in a number of states, in Florida and in Michigan, where the state has now said to the various municipalities, we're going to have a state law pertaining to drones, and we're not going to have multiple laws from each individual municipality, because, you know, some are going to say it's a maximum height of 350, another one's going to say 250, and what you've got is something that's basically untenable in terms of an operator really knowing which law applies, especially if they happen to be on the border of those municipalities.
Wouldn't the FAA rules, laws, whatever you want to call them, trump any local or state laws?
They would, and that's what we call federal preemption.
Okay.
But the problem here is that the FAA is stretched so thin that they have so many other things to deal with. Clearly, they're not just dealing with unmanned aerial systems, otherwise known as drones, but they're dealing with manned aircraft all the time. And there's only so many people that they have. So to undertake basically what would be required here is some type of a lawsuit by the FAA against either a state or a municipality and saying, you know what, we're going to have some case law here to establish our federal preemption. And that's the problem, is that's very costly, and it requires a lot of man hours involved. But I think we're going to see that. I think the one thing that we should all remember is this is just like the beginning of manned aviation. You know, right after the Wright brothers flew and people started to fly, everybody was trying to sort out what the rules were, what the regulations were. The FAA has not been in place for that many years. I think it's probably around 40, or it might be a little longer now. But they came about after a major air crash where the government decided, wait a minute, we need somebody to regulate the national airspace. So this is the same thing. We've got a new technology, and we're all learning. And as you mentioned at the very beginning, the law is always catching up with technology. The problem that we have nowadays is the technology used to go at a reasonable pace, and the law had an ability to catch up. Now we're seeing technology move at this exponential rate. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is the bureaucracy is moving at a glacial speed, and so that divide is getting greater. But I think at some point we'll start to see some equilibrium, but it's going to take a while.
Dave, what sort of ordinances are in place here in St. Louis for affecting you guys?
I don't know of any local ordinances.
State?
Missouri does not currently have any state ordinances about drones.
So who do you look for your guidance?
Well, we follow the Part 107 regulations from the FAA, you know, that put height restrictions and speed restrictions and, you know what airspace you're in. You know, in certain, like in downtown St. Louis, you would have to contact the Parks Airport over in Cahokia to get clearance to fly downtown. I also think it's interesting too, like for me as a professional news photographer, I see a lot of amateurs go out and fly missions that I would never be able to fly. And I'm like, and then I see that appear on news. I mean, Mickey, that's sort of like this weird thing we're in, where you have amateurs going up and doing things, and then the news media is being accused of, violating rules as well.
And that's a real problem. I mean, we're all trying to, as I said, be good stakeholders, but there's nothing to stop somebody from coming along with their drone and being a bad actor. And unfortunately, it's very hard to distinguish whose drone is whose, which is one of the reasons for registration and for identification numbers on each drone, so they can figure out who it belongs to. But, yeah, we're all kind of being painted with the same broad brush, which is one of the reasons that, at least from the National Press Photographers Association's point of view and other organizations, we really want to do things as properly as we can, so that we don't draw the ire of the public and they get a better understanding of how valuable a tool drones can be in news gathering.
We've had some incidents locally where some amateurs have flown over crowds. Of course, if one of these things drops into a crowd, somebody's going to get killed. Very quickly, time is running out, and David, I'll have this one for you. We have a tweet here: a big difference between a helicopter and a drone flying over somebody's backyard, because you can hear the helicopter, you can hear the airplane, you can't hear the drone.
This person's obviously never heard a drone. I think drones are pretty loud. I mean, if you get it up a few hundred feet, you're still going to hear it. You maybe have a harder time seeing it, but they're not silent. They make a lot of noise.
Well, that's comforting to the writer of that email. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Very interesting discussion. More to come, obviously, as law and rules catch up with the technology. David Carson with the Post-Dispatch and Mickey Oesterreicher for the National Press Photographers Association. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
To see you.
Thank you.
Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. This is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.